Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Travis Weador on the show from Weador Capital. But before we begin, I have to let everyone know that this episode is sponsored by Songfinch. Travis, have you heard of Songfinch by any chance?
I have not.
Well, since it is a sponsor, I'll tell you a little bit about it. It's a personalized gifting company that basically brings you stories, feelings, and memories to life through one-of-a-kind songs. And basically with the option to have a song created from scratch or to personalize an existing song foundation, their community of professional songwriters will handcraft the most personal gift you can give. It's the perfect gift for anniversaries, weddings, Mother's Days, Father's Days, birthdays, or any other, you know, special life occasion like going to your first Berkshire Hathaway meeting. So songs start at $99 and they're delivered within 7 days. They work with over 300 professional musicians. So your one-of-a-kind song will sound like it actually belongs on the radio and not like a crappy little corny jingle. Once completed, your song lives on a personal URL called your story homepage, where you can listen and download any song, read the lyrics, learn about the songwriter, and share your song on social platforms. For listeners of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you can use the promo code INVEST at checkout, and you get 10% off your song from scratch, and it might be the best gift that you've ever been given. And if you're a value investor, you probably can afford it too. So with that being said, Travis, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me back on here.
Well, yeah, welcome back to the show. Really,
yeah.
you know, you give a good interview when I welcome you back.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought it'd be cool to bring you back. You know, I love the way that you think. I love the way that you analyze companies, and you tend to understand business at a pretty in depth level. And I thought it'd be cool to maybe talk about you know, maybe two or three companies today that you thought were of interesting value and maybe some interesting business models or just interesting to talk about to the listeners. So, you know, what would be one that you'd like to start off with?
Oh, I think one of the first ones is Callaway's Nursery, which I know you and I have talked about before.
Yeah, and I would say actually just for full disclosure that I am a shareholder in the company, and clients of mine are also shareholders. So I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Yeah, yep, and same with me there. And they're a – Callaway's Nursery is a very simple business model, really. They own 19 garden centers around Texas, mostly in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They own one in Houston. So right off the bat, I was attracted to this business for a couple reasons. I think it's a pretty durable business model. I don't think garden centers is one of those things that's going to get taken out by the internet, at least anytime soon. You know, if you're buying some plants for your garden or plants for your house, ordering one offline is very different than going in person and seeing the actual physical plant that you're buying and, you know, going to landscape your house with. So I think it's a pretty durable business model. I think they have some kind of local, very local scale advantages. Most garden centers are kind of located apart from each other. You're generally not going to open a garden center across the street from another garden center. You know, if you think about your own town or city, you know, in little suburbia areas where there's a few neighborhoods, there'll usually be a garden center, and you know, most people in those neighborhoods will go to that local garden center, and, you know, maybe they'll drive another 5 or 10 miles down the road to go to another one. But generally, you know, each garden center kind of has a little local advantage. Callaway's Nursery is by far the biggest garden centers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, so that also gives them some purchasing advantages. I think the second biggest garden center only has, I want to say, 4 locations, whereas they have 18. So it's a nice little business. You know, nothing, you know, crazy fancy like a Facebook or Amazon or something like that, but just one of those little local businesses that has been doing very well. It got overtaken a couple years ago by a guy named Peter Kamen, who, you know, some investors, some listeners are probably familiar with. He had a very successful career at Value Act and then decided to go out on his own and just manage his own money. So it's permanent capital. He's invested slash taken over a handful of public companies, and I think all of them have done very, very well. He came into Callaway's Nursery. He's been in it for a while, but he took control of it, I want to say, was it about a year and a half ago or so now? And, I mean, the operating improvements have been, I mean, just quite substantial. Revenue has accelerated. Operating margins have expanded well beyond what I expected when I was first looking at the company. So, it seems like he's, you know, improved the company a lot, and I still think there's some ways to go. I still own the company, obviously. I still like it. Still think it's undervalued, and yeah.
Now let's talk about that. How are you looking at valuation of that company?
Yeah, so it's a pretty mature business, very simple business. I think it's cheap on just a simple multiples basis. I think for a lot of like companies that are growing fast, looking at multiples is kind of worthless. But Callaway's is a relatively mature company. I mean, if you look at, if you just slap like a 12.5x multiple on what their 2017 earnings are probably going to end up being, I mean, it's undervalued on just a very simple basis like that. I also have, you know, a pretty simple discounted cash flow model for the company. Again, it's very simple business, so discounted cash flow is relatively simple. You know, there's not 30 inputs like there are with some companies. And so there, but really the biggest thing in the discounted cash flow is it's a mature business, so I'm only assuming like GDP-like growth of 2-3% from now into perpetuity. So that's pretty simple and, you know, hopefully conservative. But so the biggest factor is just operating margins. Can they continue to expand operating margins? Or are they going to come back down some? But my kind of baseline scenario is that they'll actually come down some. I mean, they've expanded operating margins tremendously the past year and a half, and I think, you know, part of that is probably Peter Kamen coming in and improving operational stuff, of course, but also, you know, we're 9 years into a bull market, and you know, I think some of that is just kind of due to where we're at in the economy and stuff like that. So but even assuming operating margins drop back down to where they were like a year or two ago, the company still looks very cheap. If these operating margins are sustainable in the future, the company's going to look extremely cheap. And, you know, I'm certainly not predicting that operating margins go up anymore, but if somehow they do, then, it's going to look very, very cheap. even from this point, it's just, you know, the stock's up 100% or almost 100% in the past year or so.
Yeah. And what are you valuing at now, if you had a put an intrinsic value estimate to it?
Yeah, I think of companies with a relatively wide range of value. I generally don't say like Callaway's Nursery is worth $8.57. I kind of do a
56 cents, excuse me.
Yeah, sorry. So I generally am valuing companies in like several different ways and kind of, you know, conservative, more aggressive, and then kind of come with a range. But I think, you know, a fair value range is somewhere in the $8 to $10 range. I think my kind of what I would consider my baseline valuation is, I believe it's a little under $9. Something I haven't mentioned and which I don't put too much focus on, but they also own.
They own a lot of land. I was literally just going to ask you about that. How do you look at the land?
Yes, so they own, 11 or 12 of their locations, and they also own some parking lots and kind of a couple of random things. But, they own most of their locations. If you look at it on just a simple, like, tax-assessed value, I think it comes out to, like, $1.50 or $2 worth of value per share, which is quite significant for a stock that's, you know, 760 or something like that. Now you can argue I'm not a real estate specialist or anything like that. I've heard legitimate arguments of why Texas tax assessed values are generally undervalued. You know, there are also examples where those tax assessed values are overvalued. Callaway's has an example from a few years ago where a property sold for like five times the tax assessed value or something crazy. So I would think very conservatively, just using the tax assessed values, you know, that might add another $1.50 or $2 per share, but I don't really, I'm not really factoring that into my valuation at all. I'm investing for the core operating business and, you know, what I think Peter Kamen's done so far, what he can continue to do. And if they occasionally sell a location or do a sale leaseback or something like that, you know, that'll be a nice little bonus, but I'm not counting on that at all.
So what do you think there's left for Peter Kamen to do at the company? You know, if you were in his shoes, what would be the next course of action?
Well, one of the struggles with Callaway's Nursery, this is not a great answer to your question, but they do not communicate with investors at all. They won't take investor calls. They will straight up tell you that they won't take your calls. You can't. I've talked to quite a few shareholders, including yourself, and I don't think I've talked to anyone who's been able to get one of the managers on the phone.
It's literally it's like a one page, you know, report.
Like no commentary. Yeah, so they went dark, or I guess not technically.
They're not dark.
Yeah, not dark, but like the most limited. They released the three financial statements, and that's it. And that's all you get. They do have an annual meeting that you can. I unfortunately couldn't go to the annual meeting this past year. I had conflict. Hopefully, I can go this year. But the annual meeting.
If you end up going this year, I'd like to have you back on and talk about it.
Yeah, and it's only 3 hours away from where I live down in Austin, Texas. So it's not hard for me to go to. So, kind of back to your question, is it's hard to know, you know, what exactly he has done to improve the operations just over the past couple of years. So it's hard to say, you know, what he has done and, you know, if there's anything more kind of to do from here. So I don't know if I have a great answer to you. You know, with these like OTC pink companies that really don't release too much information, it's more of like, okay, it's a very simple business. You can look at the financials, and it's pretty clear on a very simple financial basis, you know, the company's undervalued.
I could see him taking it private at some point, if you wanted. That's just my view.
If
I was him, that's what I would do.
Yeah, and he has done that, I believe, once or maybe twice, where he's owned a majority ownership of a public company, and then he's ended up taking it private. So I think that's a very realistic option. And fortunately, he's the one time that he did it.
A good deal for shareholders. He wasn't an asshole.
Yeah, he paid like a 40% premium or something, and I talked to another money manager who was actually an investor in that company several years ago, and, you know, he said he was happy with the price. He thought it was fair. He didn't think Kamen was screwing shareholders or anything like that.
Which is very common with situations like this.
Yes, that's certainly a risk, you know, in any of these small OTC, you know, dark companies. There are plenty of, you know, a lot of investors completely avoid any OTC companies just because there's a lot of shady stuff that goes on, a lot of scams, but there's also, you know, a few kind of diamonds in the rough and legitimate companies, and you can
especially in this, I'll just interject here, in this day and age where you have all this money flowing into, you know, indexing, I think a lot of the smaller parts of the market have been completely left behind in this bull market.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and, you know, a small company like Callaway's Nursery, you know, any big company like an S&P 500 has a ton of, you know, investors just from mutual funds and index funds and ETFs that are automatically buying shares on a regular basis. And, you know, these tiny companies are completely ignored by the vast majority of Wall Street. So there are some, you know, opportunities. I think if Callaway's Nursery was a $500 million company, it would, you know, be much more fairly valued. Whereas because it's undervalued just on such a simple basis. There's nothing, you know, fancy about it. It's simple look at the financials and, you know, it's cheap.
Yeah, interesting. Anything else you want to say about that before we move on to the next one?
I don't think so. Like I said, yeah, it's a very simple company. There's not a, I wish they had a full like 10K that, you know, there's kind of a little more to analyze, or I've talked to, you know, Peter before or something like that, but there just isn't a ton there.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with simple.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
And I've also, you know, I will say I'm based in Austin. I have visited several of their locations, and the only employees I've talked to are just the like store managers and stuff like that.
Do they even know they're public? Have you ever asked them about that?
If the employees know they're public?
Well, like, have you ever asked, like, do they even know they're a public company?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I would bet you a lot of them don't.
Yeah, I would guess not as well. I've just, you know, just kind of asked them general questions about working there and stuff like that. But
you're weird. You're like, do they wonder why you're asking all these questions?
Probably. I probably just think I'm a weird consumer or something.
Which you might be too. I don't know. I did want to ask you one thing. This is something that I get asked a lot, is, and I want to hear your opinion on it, is, you know, what stops, say, a larger company from coming in and hurting Callaway's margins? Like, let's say, a Walmart has a nursery, one of their super centers, or some hardware stores do that. You know, what do you say to people that would ask you about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, some of their biggest competitors are Home Depot and Lowe's, who, I don't know if all, but most Home Depot and Lowe's locations also have garden centers attached to them. So they're kind of differentiated in that Callaway's is a little higher end, and also a lot more, they have a much, much wider variety of items. So if you want to, you know, get some generic trees and plants and, you know, potting soil and all that stuff, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's is going to be fine for you, and they're probably going to have what you're looking for. A Callaway's is really an entire store that's just all garden center items, much wider variety, a little bit more expensive. They have very, very friendly, like, return policies, and they'll actually come out and help you plant stuff. And so they're very targeted around, you know, true gardeners. So, I mean, Home Depot and Lowe's have had those garden centers for, you know, I don't even know how long, decades probably, and plenty of local garden centers like Callaway's Nursery and tons of other tiny ones around every city in America, you know, are still able to do just fine. So I would think if that argument was, you know, crushing to someone like a Callaway's Nursery, it probably would have happened 10 or 15 years ago. And, you know, they continue to, you know, do just fine in their little niche that they have.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the next company.
So Franklin Covey was another one that we discussed talking about, and that's I think it's really interesting. It's in that they're going through this business transition where, like, 2 years ago, 2-3 years ago, and their history before then. Well, first of all, I should say what they do. I guess they're a third party. They do training for other companies and other employees, but it's not like if I'm a programmer at Facebook, I'm not going to get trained by Franklin Covey to do programming. It's more kind of like soft things like how to be a better leader, how to manage employees better, how to be a better coworker. It's like leadership training, and they also do a lot of, like, kind of psychology stuff, like cognitive biases, and which a lot of investors are very, you know, familiar with cognitive biases. And learning about those, but a lot of people aren't as familiar with those things. So making employees aware of their cognitive biases and how does that affect you in the workplace, and, you know, trying to make them more efficient employees. So up until 2015, Franklin Covey provided that product and service through individual training programs. So a company would go to Franklin Covey and say, we want to train, you know, 100 employees to be, you know, better at leadership or whatever. And they would pay Franklin Covey $200 per course. So it was a very discreet purchase, $200 for 100 employees. And that would be that. And then if Franklin Covey wanted to sell that same company, you know, more training materials, it would be a separate discrete sale. So it wasn't, while they had a lot of recurring customers, the business model wasn't inherently recurring. So now from 2016 to 2017, they went through this business transition, and they're just now kind of exiting the transition period. But they went through this major transition where for that same $200 per course, now that that employee has access to all of Franklin Covey's training materials instead of paying $200 for one, you know, specific training class or material or whatever it is, now you're paying $200 and getting a one-year subscription to everything that they have, or almost everything. Not, there's still, you know, upgrades and add-ons and stuff.
So they're basically a subscription model now for their services.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so they're transitioning to a SaaS model. And if you've ever looked at companies that are kind of in the process of going through a SaaS model, it basically kills your GAAP financials for a couple years, because you go from recognizing 100% of revenue when you sell that training course to now you recognize that revenue over a 12-month period, but you recognize all the expenses up front. So your GAAP financials, your revenue decreases quite a bit. You still have the same expenses that you had before. So if you look at the stock price the past couple of years, it's, you know, has not been great. They just about a month ago, they released Q1 2018 earnings on a weird fiscal year, which was the first quarter that's a full first quarter that's like fully lapping their transition period. And I mean, in my opinion, they totally blew the results out of the water. It's looking, you know, you don't want to put too much emphasis on one quarter results, but it was significantly better than I was expecting. The past 2 years have been very hard to really parse through the financials. There's a lot of kind of muddiness in the financials while they're going through this transition. So, you know, there's certainly some guessing as to how the financials are going to look when they get through the transition. But it's looking like it's going to be even better than I was expecting. And the stock is up. The stock shot up about almost 50% on the results. It's come back down since. But I'm surprised it's not significantly higher. I think it's, as of today, it's around 25 or 30% higher after the Q1 results. But I think they have, you know, quite a ways to go.
And how are you calculating the intrinsic value for the company?
Yeah, so it's tough. And that's something, there are no shortage of bears on Franklin Covey and people who are short Franklin Covey, and you can, you know, find online quite a few short write-ups. And one of the things that I think a lot of, and I've also talked to plenty of these people as well, they focus a lot on the financials the past couple of years, which the financials have not looked great. And that's a legitimate concern, but what really matters is what are the financials going to look at, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. But it's very hard to take their like 2017 financials and kind of look at them, you know, how are those going to change looking forward, because it's just, there's just too much noise in the financials. So how I was thinking about it previously, and this is on a very simplified basis, but before they started this transition, so from like 20, if you look at like 2013 to 2015 results, when they were purely selling these individual discrete training courses for $200 per course, I estimated their like normalized earnings or owner earnings or whatever you call it, we're in the 7 to 8% range. And I was kind of thinking, you know, this new business model is a better business model. It's more efficient. You have customers who are auto-renewing as opposed to having to discreetly sell them items, you know, every single time. So I think it's a more efficient model. I think earning margins should improve. So I was kind of thinking, you know, if the earning margins before this transition were 7 to 8%, maybe they can be 9% when they get through the transition. And that's kind of how I was valuing the company the past year or so. Now that we have at least one quarter of results and we've had a phone call with management and, you know, we can kind of see, kind of get a better idea of what these new results look like going forward, it looks like management is predicting their earnings margins, free cash flow margins are going to be quite a bit higher than 9%, which, you know, blew me away, but obviously I hope they're right. So if you do a... So if you look at just, you know, revenue growth, 8 to 10%, 12% for a few years, and then they eventually get to 10% free cash flow margins or 12%. Management is predicting like 15%, which is, you know, absolutely incredible. But even, you know, 10 or 12%, if you look at, you know, if they can do $275 million in revenue in 2 years, which would be very reasonable. They're going to, their guidance for this year is around $227 million. So if they do $275 million in revenue in a couple of years, they earn, say, a 12 or 14% free cash flow margin. Again, management's predicting like 15 or 16%. But then you just discount that those free cash flow dollars back a few years. I mean, it's materially higher than today's price. I've also done a discounted cash flow on the company, which, you know, I do discounted cash flows for pretty much every company I own. I know the common argument against discounted cash flows, if you change one little number, you can get a whole different output. But I like to do quite a few discounted cash flow models, and, you know, see kind of come up with like a range of fair values. Because on Franklin Covey, it's if you assume the new business model is going to have higher gross margins, it should have lower, like their operating margins should also be, their operating expenses should be lower on a margin basis.
Right.
So when you, and they're also predicting revenue growth to increase. So when you kind of have these multiple levers that are happening, you know, revenue growth, and then gross margins are going up, and then operating expense leverage is also increasing. I think it's hard to fully appreciate how much that affects the financials 2 or 3 or 4 years out without doing some type of discounted cash flow model. Because it's easy to say, like, okay, you know, they're going to continue to grow revenue, gross margin might come up a little bit, and operating margins going to increase even more than gross margins. And but when you see those, how those factors play, like kind of compound for a few years, it's pretty incredible. So you know, factoring in those various valuation methods, I struggle to get a price lower than like $30 per share. I also didn't even say they're the highest taxpayer. I mean, I think that I'm even aware of any company I follow. They were paying like 40 to 42% effective taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to benefit from the tax cut way more than most companies. But I really struggle to get a fair value lower than $30. I think, you know, a more realistic number is probably going to be $35 or $40 after a few more quarters or a year or two. Again, they are, if you look at, on the Q1 results that came out a month ago, management gave a 5-year sensitivity analysis for the financials, which I was surprised they even did that because management's generally pretty conservative. And definitely, they've never done anything like that before where they release, like, what they think financials can look like over the next several years. They give short-term guidance, but they've never done anything like that. And I mean, their predictions of what this new business model can accomplish in a few years is incredible. And it's quite a bit more than I was expecting. So we only have one quarter financials. The one quarter, like I said, I thought they absolutely knocked it out of the park. But I think it's hard to, give too many, give too narrow of an estimate of what the financials are going to look like, just because they just got through this 2-year transition period. We've only had one quarter of like fully lapped financials. Don't want to put, they look great, but don't want to put too much emphasis just on one quarter. So I think a few more quarters from now, we'll have a much better idea of, you know, how this new business model is looking and how the financials are going to flow and that type of thing.
Yeah. Where do they get, no, how do they get their customers?
Very traditional Salesforce. I mean, they have a lot of salespeople that, you know, call on, you know, all these different companies.
Are they cold calling, or what's, do you know the process behind that?
Both, yeah. So there's cold callers. They also have, so they have facilitators who are actually people who work in companies. So these aren't Franklin Covey employees. They're employees of other companies, but they might be like a head of HR manager, or maybe just a manager at these other companies who have taken Franklin Covey's courses, mm-hmm. and are kind of believers in Franklin Covey, and they will like train their own employees on Franklin Covey stuff. And so they get a lot through these facilitators. They have, I don't know, a ton of facilitators in various companies, you know, all around the country. But then they also have a traditional sales force. I was at a Franklin Covey event about a month ago up in Dallas, and a bunch of their customers were there, and you know, there were some facilitators there and stuff, and it was incredible that there were several facilitators who were repeating things verbatim from Franklin Covey's like training materials. Like, these people were such believers in Franklin Covey's trainings that they knew some of the stuff, just spouting it off the top of their head. They were directly quoting Franklin Covey training materials. So they have a very large kind of mind share. A lot of people, you know, it's funny. I think twice in the past year I've read a book that has mentioned Franklin Covey. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, they've been around forever. Stephen Covey wrote the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which is a very, very popular book. It's still selling books, copies like 30 years later. I just watched a, I forget what it was. I just watched a movie a couple weeks ago that mentioned Franklin Covey in the movie. I was like, well, that's so random. But yeah, they have, they're the biggest company in the space, so they have a lot of mind share, and yeah, it's interesting. But they also, they're the biggest company in the space, but it's also a very, I mean, they only have, well, kind of depends how you measure it, but I mean, they have, they're the largest company in the space, but they only have a very small percent of the market, like low single digits or something, again, depending on how you want to measure it. But from a broad, from a high level, I think most people would say they have like low single digit percentage of market share.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Want to do let's do like one more company.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the other one we talked about was Issuer Direct. This is another. This is.
And you own them as well, I assume.
Yeah, I own them, and
what do they do exactly?
Yeah, they basically help public companies, and they do work with private companies too, but mostly public companies be public companies, basically. So they have a lot of different products and services. There are a few that really drive the vast majority of their value, but they do things like their old business. They're actually kind of going through a business transition similar to Franklin Covey. It's not nearly as disruptive to their business, but a major part of their business used to be like printing annual reports and distributing annual reports and printing proxy materials and distributing those. And, you know, as we're all aware, a lot of that is going away. A lot of it's going to electronic and emailed. And so they've kind of had this legacy business that is decreasing, and then they've also kind of disrupted themselves a little bit, to use something from Clayton Christensen, who's on Franklin Covey's board, by the way. So they've kind of disrupted themselves, going more like software, and they're kind of through their transition by now, but they still have that legacy business that is shrinking every quarter that does kind of hurt their financials. So they have a press release business. They have a stock transfer agency. They run like a whistleblower hotline for companies.
What's the transfer agent
under there? Yeah, so there's a ton of stock transfer agents. There's probably hundreds of them in the U.S. or something, but they basically keep track of a company's.
Oh no, I know what that is. I'm asking you. Explain to the listeners what it is if they don't know what that is. But that wasn't my question.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood your question.
But explain what a transfer agent is to people in case they don't know.
So they just keep track of the list of shareholders of a company. So if Fidelity sells a million shares of Bank of America, then whoever their stock transfer agent is will, you know, kind of keep track of that. And it's a very important kind of behind the scenes aspect of public companies, but it's a very, very sticky business, which I didn't know this before learning, researching Issuer Direct. But so to change a stock transfer to change your stock transfer agent, you have to get board approval, and it's kind of a major hassle and a big deal to change your stock transfer agent. So the vast majority of companies will just stick with their, like, basically from when they IPO to, you know, when they're no longer a public company, they will stick with just one agent that entire time. And the VP of sales of Issuer Direct told me they've lost fewer than five stock agent clients in their history over the past, you know, 15 or 20 years or something. So very, very, very sticky business. So, and that's great for, because Issuer Direct has quite a few different products and services. It's nice that they have, you know, some of their products and services are very, very sticky. So that allows them to cross sell those clients on some of these other services and upsell them on different services. And they just bought another, they just like, I think almost tripled the size of their stock transfer business. They made an acquisition a few months ago that I think roughly tripled their stock transfer business. So that's something that they're trying to do more of. And So what was your
question was what's the name what's the name of their transfer agent that they go under by? I'm just curious.
The one they just bought is Interwest. I'm trying to remember what is. Crap, I can't think of it.
Okay, I was just curious. Anyway, go ahead. Yeah, so what are some of their other services besides transfer agent and?
Direct transfer is it?
Okay.
They do mostly small microcap companies, and
I've heard a lot of the weird transfer agents. That's why I was curious.
Yeah, and they're very small. I think with their new acquisition of Interwest, I believe Brian said that they're going to be. I think he said in the top 10 or 15 stock transfer agents, and there's a couple that do like the majority of the industry.
How much of their revenues come from that business? It's a great business.
Yeah, it is a great business. They're like after this acquisition. So if you look to like next year, it is going to be. what, like, it's going to be pretty meaningful. It's like 20% of their revenue or something, maybe. I'm trying to look it up here really quick. I have my notes open. Yeah, it'll be a pretty, I can't find it right now. It's going to be meaningful to their business. I think somewhere in like the low double digit range. And to go to the question you just asked, probably the part of the business that's driving a lot of their value today is AccessWire. And this is a press release business that mainly focuses on small and micro cap companies. How they kind of differentiate themselves is they're roughly half the cost of the big eight news distribution guys, and they're also much simpler. So like PR Newswire, Market Wired, they will actually charge like a flat fee, and then they will also charge like anything above a couple hundred words, they will charge like on a per word basis, or they will upcharge you for like including a link in the press release or things like that. Whereas AccessWire is a flat fee. I think they have like two different levels basically for fees. So it's very simple. Brian described it to me. Brian's the CEO. It's like, you know, typing an extra 100 words on a press release is completely meaningless. He's like, it's kind of stupid to charge people, upcharge someone to include a link or, you know, stuff like that. So they just do a flat fee. It's very simple. It's roughly half the price of PR Newswire and all the big guys. So they're having a lot of success growing in the microcap space, these tiny, like $5, $10 million companies.
Yep.
You know, saving a couple thousand dollars a year on press releases might be meaningful to them. You know, Apple or Microsoft or something obviously doesn't really care whether they pay $400 or $800 per press release. But some of these smaller guys, it's actually a meaningful amount of money. So AccessWire has been growing very fast. That's also a great business in the sense that it's a very hard business to get into. It's almost like a catch-22 to get into the industry because to be a news distributor, you have to have a lot of distribution. Mm-hmm. But you can only get that distribution if you have a lot of clients. You know, like some the news sites or, the online brokers aren't going to deal with you if you have five clients. They're like, no, it's not worth our time. But you also can't get clients to distribute their press releases unless you have those distribution points. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, kind of a catch-22. It's, basically like four companies have dominated the news distribution service or the news distribution market forever. AccessWire is kind of getting some market share in the low end of the market. They're still very, very small, though. So it's kind of a good business to be in, and it allows to, back to the point I made earlier, it allows Issuer Direct, since they're getting all these new AccessWire clients, to cross-sell them on, you know, a lot of these other services they have. And, you know, once you get a customer that's using two or three of your services, well, that's an extremely, extremely sticky customer who's, you know, it's just it's a much bigger disruption to that customer's business to switch away from you if they're using, you know, several of Issuer Direct services.
Right.
So their focus is just on getting as many clients kind of in the door and then cross-sell them. And once you cross-sell them on, you know, another service, that becomes a very sticky customer. And then, you know, try and upsell them over the years and things like that. And that's kind of the focus right now. It's a founder-led company. Brian founded it about 20 years ago or something. Very passionate. I like Ryan a lot. Talked to him quite a few times. Great balance sheet. I think they have, you know, large room for growth. They have zero debt on the balance sheet, a lot of cash. Brian, obviously, he's the founder. He has a lot of ownership, so very well aligned. Doesn't pay himself a bunch of money. Doesn't grant himself a bunch of stock options on an annual basis. And so a lot of kind of the high-level things I look for in a company, Issuer Direct has.
Yeah. How are the valuations on this?
So I think it's currently around $17.50 or something. It's also, you know, not quite as extreme as Franklin Covey, but you know, it is going through that business transition. So it is not easy. It's not a simple valuation like a Callaway's Nursery.
Yeah.
Which I think is one reason why, you know, Wall Street doesn't really like things that aren't quantifiable, that aren't easily measurable. So I think there's some opportunities in those things. But in general, I think it's, you know, again, those same valuation methods I've already talked about. But I think Issuer Direct's maybe worth in the low 20s or something like that. So I don't think it's as undervalued as like a Franklin Covey, where Franklin Covey's the cheapest. I mean, in my opinion, it's the cheapest stock I know of. But Issuer Direct is more of, I think it's, you know, maybe selling 20% or something below what my kind of baseline estimate of fair value is. But it's also more of like the compounder type where, you know, I'm planning on owning them for a very long time, hopefully. And I think their intrinsic value will just continue to grow over the years, even though, you know, it's not as undervalued on like a near-term basis as, you know, something like a Franklin Covey is. But yeah, so my estimate is fair value somewhere in the low 20s, maybe.
Okay, interesting. Well, interesting. I always like your analysis and like hearing about the different companies you invest in. So I, you know, appreciate you coming on the show. And again, if anyone wants to contact you, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah, I point most people just to my blog. I run an investing blog that posts ideas and just kind of general investing stuff. And my contact information is on there. But the blog is egregiouslycheap.com.
And it's a good blog. I read it.
Thank you.
All right, man. Well, it was great to have you back on the show. And hope to have you on again sometime.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, man. See ya.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.